This is the time set for on block 411. Our first case is MW versus State of Nevada, case number 64807. Counsel, you'll notice that Justice Perigary is in the courtroom in Las Vegas. He had commitments this afternoon that required him to be present in Las Vegas today, so he'll be participating in Las Vegas in these oral arguments. So are you ready to go, Mr. Langford?
I am, Your Honor.
Okay.
Counsel, may it please the Court. As an introductory matter, I would like to note that these cases that have come before the Court recently, this case, another case that my office represents coming out of the 8th Judicial District as well, on an appeal of a denial of a, or dissolving a preliminary injunction, these cases have not been litigated on their merits, none of them. The Ninth Circuit case, ACLU versus Masto, it was not litigated on the merits of what could have been shown through a discovery process, through the litigation process in a lower court. They've all been handled essentially procedurally through the preliminary injunction process, the denial of the preliminary injunction or the granting of a preliminary injunction, and the appeal of that particular decision. And that's what's happened here. I say that because without that litigation, it is difficult to articulate completely all of the ways that this law, 8579, would impact sex offenders and even other citizens of the state of Nevada, because we've not been able to show exactly what would take place with individuals and the group at large. I think that has import as I get down through further parts of my argument. Again, I want to also say that this case is separate and apart from another case that is litigated through my office. And so the briefs are not comparable and are not completely the same. This is, as I have indicated, a dissolving of a preliminary injunction that had been issued in the 8th Judicial District Court. It was heard before Judge Rob Bear, who made some interesting observations about the law. And I understand that this court in other cases has said that it's not seen a punitive effect. But I think that it is worth noting that as Judge Bear had the individuals before him, he certainly believed that it had a punitive effect. He claimed it had a, and stated it had a punitive effect. Likewise, when asked, the state could not articulate, at least at the time, could not articulate how it was not a punitive law.
Mr. Langford, notwithstanding the fact that you have pointed out this case has not been litigated, the appeal is from the order dissolving a preliminary injunction. Is that correct?
That's correct, Your Honor.
And therefore, you would have to be able to articulate what you see as the reasonable likelihood of success on the merits. Can you explain that for me?
Yes, and we have done that in our brief, I believe, in that first there's the separation of powers clause.
And was that raised below? Was that raised below?
It was not raised with regards to MW. It has been raised in other cases, indeed the other case that I indicated earlier from my office. It is still applicable in this particular case because it does fall under several causes of action that were raised by MW. Our office did not have the original complaint. We came in, indeed, the day that Judge Bear heard the evidentiary hearing on it, or the argument on it.
So, and I'm sorry, I did interrupt your explanation of reasonable likelihood.
Yes, it does go to some causes of action that were raised in the original complaint by MW. And those are the due process, general due process, denial of due process, and other cases that were raised by him. You could still say that this supports arguments that he has made in his complaint. And the separation of powers is indeed one of those, in that if you look to the Ohio case, The Ohio case that we cite in our brief, Bodike, indicates that where the legislative branch comes in and there have been previous judicial determinations with regards to some individuals, and the legislature then comes in and says, we don't care, we are going to extend the amount of registration time, regardless of whatever judicial rulings have been made in the past with regards to this individual, we're going to extend it. The Ohio court found that that was a separation of powers issue.
Isn't that a bit awkward in this case, though, because as I understand it, your client was convicted in Colorado and served out his probation there successfully to his credit, and then moved to Nevada. And so as I was reading these briefs, I was puzzling over how you would, assuming we got to separation of powers, how we have a separation of powers offense under our Nevada Constitution.
I think that he still has, and it certainly is not as strong as to MW, as it is to other individuals. But again, as it applies to other individuals, still sort of counts as to MW, in that what is the effect of the law? And the effect of the law is, even as to MW, MW came to, and this dovetails with our contracts clause argument. MW is doing well on his probation, successfully completed, as Justice Pickering pointed out, has successfully completed it, makes a decision after looking at other states and looking at what he's going to be required to do should he come to Nevada, and seeing what's happened in the past to other individuals, he makes a decision to come to Nevada. He comes to Nevada, and he's doing well here. He is classified as a Tier 1 offender. All of a sudden, the legislature comes in, and I would add, he has subjected himself to the statutory scheme in place at the time, which granted such things as a procedural due process. Should he be mistakenly classified, he has redress through the court system under the old scheme.
We started off, the question was, as of the separation of powers, and we kind of start sliding to the side on it. But as a separation of powers, we have a final judgment. The court's not being asked to do anything to change the final judgment, which it really can't because it's a judgment from another state. The court is not being asked to apply any discretion. It's the administrative end, which makes it, based on case authority other than Bodai, it moves it outside that separation of powers argument that you're evoking, because the court's not changing anything. And the court's not in a position, the way our statute is written or enacted or administrated, to change anything. It's left to the administrative body or a delegate who does things with whether or not sex offenders should have to report or don't have to report and things of that nature. So how does this even fall in the separation of powers?
Justice Douglas, I would say that he could, if something did happen, he could avail himself of the judicial process. Again, as I indicated, it is not as strong as MW because he has not had need to do that. But as I was indicating, had something happened where he was mistakenly reclassified, or he felt that the classification that he had received was unfair, he had judicial redress. It's true indeed, and I'm going to concede that he did not need to avail himself of that process. And so, since he has not had a particular judicial determination in his case, it is a weaker argument. But one could still argue that even though his judicial determination was outside of the state of Nevada, there was still a judicial determination that was by the state of Colorado. He successfully completed his probation. There is a judicial ruling when you successfully
But he still had a lifetime tail on him. Did he not?
He did, but that is separate from a registration requirement.
Well, he chose a state where if he was convicted in another jurisdiction of a particular offense, he had requirements. Is that not the case?
That's correct. That is correct.
So then he falls within that ambit, so to speak, of having to abide by those conditions of that state that he comes into.
I'm sorry, when he moved to Nevada?
Yes.
Yes. Yes. And I guess then the point is, I think the stronger argument, indeed, is the contracts clause argument.
And in this case, it's not a plea, so how do we get into the contracts clause?
Well, I think that when he came to Nevada and subjected himself to the laws of the state of Nevada and then invested himself in the state of Nevada, and I would like to reserve 3 minutes of time. I apologize for not saying that up front. When he availed himself and then invested in the state of Nevada, he made certain decisions on how he was going to live his life. I think that the contracts clause kicked in. He made a bargain with the state of Nevada.
So we didn't get into unilateral and bilateral first-year contracts discussions?
There's a reason I went into criminal law. It's why I ask that the preliminary injunction be in place and that we send it back down for the purposes of litigating all of the issues and truly determining what all of the effects are, what the circumstances were when he came to the state of Nevada. We have not been able, we've not been required to do that at this point. There is.
Frankfurt, could you comment on the impact on your client's case on the ex post facto argument from as a result of Logan D?
Thank you, Justice Hardesty. Yes, I'd love to do that. There is irreparable harm. He goes from being a Tier 1 offender with no community notification to being a Tier 3 offender, which not only is there community notification, but it's live web community notification. His picture will be up live on the web. And as we pointed out, he has young children. He subjects them then to, and as we also pointed out in our brief, there's ample evidence to support the fact that he is at risk physically. He and his family would both be at risk, not just shame, not just scorn, but physically. There have been cases where sex offenders have suffered because they were all of a sudden there was live notification and people knew about it.
But in Logan D., the court held that as it related to juveniles, ex post facto didn't apply because it was non-punitive. The dissent disagreed, and the primary argument the dissent made was that juvenile records were not part of the public disclosure. I was interested in knowing how you would distinguish the position taken by the majority in Logan D. as it relates to now an adult case.
I think that Logan D. first factually, Your Honor, began with the non-classified juvenile offenders who had not been classified yet. Also, it was in Logan D. And in a more recent case by this court having to do with an adult offender, S.M., the court noted that the plaintiffs were unable to show punitive effect. And with all the evidence pointing to the fact that the legislative intent was not to be punitive, plaintiffs were unable to show the punitive effect. But then that argues in favor of my position.
So would your argument be, going to the commencement of your argument, these cases, at least this case, hasn't been litigated below. Given an opportunity to do discovery and establish some other issues, you might provide some factual basis for a reanalysis of the 7 factors contained in Smith that this court addressed in Logan D.
You said it much more persuasively than I ever could have, and balanced that against the irreparable harm that is done to MW.
Okay, you have some, you want to reserve time.
Thank you.
Yes, go ahead. Ms. Buchanan, how are you today?
Wonderful. Thank you. Good morning. May it please the Court. My name is Kimberly Buchanan, Senior Deputy Attorney General, on behalf of respondents. I'm here today respectfully requesting that you affirm the dissolution of the preliminary injunction in the matter of MW and follow the precedent that this Court set in the matter of Logan D. and then, of course, extended to the adult matter of SM. The SM matter contained four causes of action. In fact, the exact same four causes of action that are before you today: ex post facto, double jeopardy, substantive due process, and procedural due process.
Ms. Buchanan, can I ask you one question? Because I know you're getting into your various arguments, but in Judge Baer's order, he relies on Logan D. and also on ACLU versus Masto case. I think Mr. Lankford's talked about Logan D. Oh, what's your position regarding Logan D. and the ACLU case, how it impacts our what we do in this case?
I believe it to be controlling authority because this Court's analysis in Ray Logan D. and its analysis, particularly in the ex post facto, was not limited to the juvenile matter. The Court's decision that the legislative intent in enacting AB 579 was civil, again, was looking at the scope of the applicability of AB 579. And, of course, when the Court turned to the second part of the test, whether the effect of the law is punitive, and applied the seven Mendoza-Martinez factors, again, it wasn't limited to just the juvenile aspect. And I would assert that this Court's rationale is, in fact, precedent for this Court in determining that there is not a violation of ex post facto. And, in fact, as I think has been alluded to by the Court, even more so in an adult context. The State had a much more difficult burden in upholding the constitutionality of AB 579 in the juvenile context, because records of criminal conviction aren't as readily available as they are in the criminal context. And I believe, as Chief Justice Hardesty indicated, that was the primary thrust of the dissent's concern in Ray Logan D., and we don't have that here. The Court, in the analysis of the seven factors, indicated that the sex offender registration and notification statutes are fairly recent origin and not akin to historical punishment. They don't constitute an affirmative disability, and this Court naturally relied on the leading United States Supreme Court case of Smith v. Doe and indicated that they are but collateral consequences. Any sort of public shaming or things along those lines are collateral consequences and not the intent of the legislator's adoption of AB 579.
Counsel, this quote, we use this phrase public shaming. I think we're past public shaming of the old days where it was house to house based upon the internet and public social media. It's much broader than that. If you would respond to Mr. Lankford's basic argument that the stay should stay in place to give him an opportunity to litigate this particular case, why shouldn't that occur?
I beg your pardon, Your Honor.
Why shouldn't the stay stay in effect to allow Mr. Lankford on behalf of his client to litigate the specific facts in this case first?
Because as applied to this individual, there are no additional facts that they can allude. Again, this is prior to implementation of the law. And initially, the ACLU Masto case was a 100-plus brief. The issues regarding the constitutionality of this law, which is really what they're challenging, they're not challenging that some neighbor actually, you know, attacked MW or anything along those lines. Those are all hypotheticals. Should a scenario along those lines come up down the road, then certainly that would be something that MW could produce. But even the contracts clause analysis.
He's making an as-applied challenge here, isn't he?
Well, the law hasn't been applied yet, so I would assert that it's a facial challenge. But even as applied to MW, discovery is not needed because, again, it's a broad constitutional challenge to MW. We know the underlying facts.
But were those constitutional issues truly thoroughly vetted in this case? I mean, he, and perhaps I misunderstand the facts, but my understanding is that he pleaded guilty in Colorado, is that correct?
That's correct.
And then he served out his probationary time successfully in Colorado and whatever he had to do in Nevada. So he was off reporting when this law, had it taken effect, would have taken effect. Is that right?
Just
Well, Colorado has also adopted the Adam Walsh Act.
Didn't plead.
The briefs do say he pleaded guilty, the reply brief and the opening brief, and that's a point that I wanted to understand from you.
I believe he was convicted of attempt incest, Your Honor.
That was a different question. Did he plead guilty?
I believe so.
Yes.
Yes.
So the answer is yes. My question is, how developed was this case in the district court? There was a complaint, and then, as I understand it, a stipulated stay or the Masto case came into effect, and we were deferring to the federal district court, and it was on appeal to the Ninth Circuit. So everything freeze framed, right?
That's correct.
And the case then revived with Logan D. and Masto being decided by the Ninth Circuit, correct?
That's correct. Those decisions went
down. So was there ever anything more than the complaint? And did you answer? Did the state answer?
No, there was extensive argument. There was briefing back and forth,
right,
as Your Honor can see from the record, regarding the constitutional challenge.
But there's no discovery, no answer to the complaint, no evidentiary hearing?
Well,
there was oral argument on motions for preliminary injunction or to dissolve it, right?
That is correct, but I don't believe discovery in this matter would elicit any other facts for this court's consideration.
That's not what I'm leading up to, I'm sorry.
I apologize, Your
Honor. No, that's fine, but it was in a really infant stage as far as the arguments, and everybody was making the same arguments, roughly, Logan D., Masto, this case. And my concern when I read these briefs is we're getting new arguments from your opponent. You're answering, well, these weren't raised in the district court, they're waived. But to some extent, this case was freeze-framed with all the others. So answer this question for me. Why shouldn't we return this to the district court for a thorough airing and vetting of all the constitutional arguments that have perhaps become available now that Logan D. and Masto are decided and you have this case with a guilty plea, the guy served out his sentence, et cetera, et cetera?
Because those arguments have already been vetted in many parts.
Okay.
SLU versus Masto. Certainly, I mean, there were 20 or 25 consolidated cases in the underlying matter, one of which was MW, another was SM. A variety of constitutional arguments were made in front of Judge Baer. MW's arguments were on four constitutional causes of action, but there were many other causes of action that were raised as to other plaintiffs. Again, in ACLU versus Masto, the contracts cause analysis was at length vetted. Again, I don't believe anything in terms of discovery will alter this court's analysis. Again, the constitutional claim in terms of ex post facto was well articulated by this court in finding that there was a civil intent by the legislature and the effects weren't punitive, that procedural due process was denied along the lines of the United States Court precedent in Connecticut Department of Public Safety versus Doe, where they're not entitled to prove a fact that's not relevant to the statutory scheme. Substantive due process, this court denied in Ray Logan D., which again would be even more applicable in the adult context, which was that it does not implicate a fundamental right, and therefore the rational basis test would apply. The rational basis test, again, being the most important in upholding the law.
Yeah, that's a very difficult standard.
I have a question. Did the 2015 legislature try to do anything to modify, clarify, overrule AB 579?
Yes, Justice.
And tell us what happened.
Okay. The legislature took this court's caution, particularly in the juvenile context, to heart. And
in other words, they looked at the dissent in Logan D., that well-reasoned dissent.
Absolutely, they did, Justice Terry. And a bill, Senate Bill 99, was reworked and crafted. And both, I was proud of that bill because both prosecution and defense worked together to come up with another alternative, which amended the juvenile provisions of the bill and made a few tweaks with respect to the adult portions. For the most part, the adult portion remained, but the juvenile portion was significantly changed. It passed through Assembly, it passed through Senate, and then when it got to the governor's office, it was vetoed.
And would the MW be a Tier 3 in Colorado?
I believe so, because one of the requirements under SORNA in order to ensure you're compliant with the feds is that certain offenses need to be a Tier 3 offense, and one is sexual abuse. And in 432B, I believe it's 100, it sets forth the different crimes that are considered sexual abuse, one of which is incest.
Would he be Tier 3 like in California, New Mexico, Arizona, Utah, any of our neighboring states? In other words, Colorado would be Tier 3. What about the other states? Because he did choose to come to Colorado, to come to Nevada.
I don't know that, Your Honor. I apologize. But again, Adam Walsh has been enacted in Colorado, and if he was in his home state, one of the assertions in the briefing that I saw was that he would be free and clear if he hadn't come to Nevada and he was in his home state, and that's not correct at all. And again, registration is separate and distinct from the punishment. This court, as well as Smith v. Doe, has indicated it's but a collateral consequence.
So you dispute whether in the representation that he's completely clear in Colorado?
Absolutely.
Okay.
I do.
Okay.
And in fact, there is extensive case law from across the state. In fact, in the dissent, it's a footnote that indicates that across the state, in California, which hasn't adopted Adam Walsh, but California, Arizona, Colorado, there's many states that have held that sex offender registration and notification schemes may be retroactively applied for the exact same reason that this court held, which is that it's civil in nature. The purpose, again, for that rational connection is public safety, notifying the public of the presence of sex offenders and allowing the public to take whatever protective means they deem necessary is rationally related to legitimate government interest.
Would MW have the argument under Bodike in Colorado?
No, they would not.
And why not?
Okay, Ohio's system for placing a sex offender into a tiering is done judicially. So the judges actually weigh the dangerousness of the offender. That's distinct from what we have in Nevada. In Nevada, it's done by the Department of Public Safety, and there's several states that distinguish Boyke on the same basis who have systems similar to us, like Nebraska, where it's the Department of Public Safety that follows the Attorney General guidelines and weighs the risks of recidivism for the current system that we have now to determine the tier of the individual. And the analysis in those cases indicates that it's the that it's by operational law when Adam Walsh comes in that the person is re-tiered and it's not a reopening of judicial determination all along the lines of what Justice Douglas has already indicated.
I understand that argument as it relates to Nevada. Mike, do with whether this individual, how would it operate in Colorado? If he returned to Colorado, your position is he'd be a Tier 3 under their Adam Walsh Act. My question is, does Colorado's scheme more replicate Ohio's or Nevada's?
It's more similar to, my understanding is it's more similar to Nevada in that it's done by more of the executive agency. It's not a judicial determination or a judicial weighing of factors.
And that's how it was at the time he pleaded and sentenced?
I can't speak to that, Your
Honor. Okay.
See, these are questions, though, that go back to Justice Pickering and my question earlier about whether the record in this matter requires development. Some of the issues here may be something that the trial court needs to know about, or at least we need to know factually before you assess, as an example, the separation of powers argument. If this court were to accept the position taken in Bodike and we find out that there's a system in Colorado that's different, then perhaps the analysis is different.
But again, the system in Nevada is different, and other states have distinguished Ohio and not. Ohio's case is predicated on its Ohio Constitution and the manner in which determinations are made. That's not what we have here. Again, Colorado is more akin to the Nevada system. There's no additional facts that they can assert to demonstrate that it's somehow different. The states that have distinguished Boyke do so on the basis that Adam Walsh coming in and re-tiering individuals isn't a reopening of a judgment, but again, just merely by operation of law, the individuals in the civil regulatory system increase their tier factor. So I would assert that there's no additional facts that can be asserted below. Ohio, for its state, determined something different. Ohio also found it violated ex post facto. For those reasons, we would request that you uphold the dissolution of the criminal.
I have one more question about the at-risk argument that Mr. Langford made. It's something new as far as I'm concerned. What about the at-risk? Don't you think we should have an evidentiary hearing in district court to see about at-risk for the offenders?
Meaning whether or not they have a risk of recidivism?
Well, what Justice Douglas said about now, it's, you know, with the way social media is, where everybody knows somebody's a sex offender, you know, maybe they'll be at some kind of meeting and somebody will walk in like they did in South Carolina and blow everybody away. I mean, I think he deserves a hearing on that.
And that's exactly what this court analyzed in Ray Logan D. They found it wasn't excessive. And again, this court quoted Smith v. Doe, indicating it wasn't excessive in scope just because the regulatory system was predicated on the conviction as opposed to the risk of recidivism. That does not make it excessive in its scope or punitive in nature.
Yeah, I was not that I'm taking anybody's side on this, but the at-risk also is not only to the public but also to the offender who has successfully completed his probation. It was a different argument that I had never heard before, the at-risk of the offender.
Mm-hmm. May I address that, or am I?
Go right ahead.
Just very briefly. One of the concerns in Ray Logan D. was the potential risk and retribution, the stigma, the retribution from the public. And there is actually a provision within the law that provides that the information on the website is not to be used. And this court mentioned that and indicated, again, that the purpose of the dissemination was not for harm to the offender, but, again, public safety. So I believe that balancing has already been done by this court.
Thank you, Ms. Buchanan. Mr. Langford, I'll give you 2 minutes additional time. You can go ahead with your rebuttal argument.
Thank you, Justice Hardesty. I apologize, Justice Douglas. I believe I may have misspoken. I think it was a plea, and he was not convicted. So I think that would have some impact. With all due respect to counsel for the Attorney General, saying that Colorado is more akin to Nevada than Ohio is seems to me a bit vague and ambiguous. It's one of the reasons that this case needs to be more fully vetted, as has the term's been used, in the district court. The only way we can do that is to keep the preliminary injunction in place. Otherwise,
so it has. Are you aware of what the Colorado system is?
I don't know. I don't know because everything has changed so radically in the last several years. I know that Nevada is the only state that adopted the original congressional mandate intact. All the other states, none of them, passed it completely. I couldn't tell you which state was different from any other state.
Well, Nevada was threatened with the loss of federal funding. And that was a big deal. And then that turned out the United States Supreme Court said you can't take federal funding away because somebody doesn't adopt the Adam Walsh Act.
That's correct. And even prior to that, states had decided to challenge that anyway, and they were not adopting the Adam Walsh Act in its entirety. Nevada was the only one who did so. So saying that Colorado is more closely akin, I'm not sure what that means. And I'm sure the Attorney General didn't mean to you know.
Well, let's assume for the moment that Colorado is exactly the same as Ohio. Does it matter under the scheme that exists in Nevada, where executive branch determination is made as to tier classification, that has been determined to be a process that does not result in opening the judgment, which is the foundational principle that's contained in the, I call it Bo Dyke, but it's whenever you pronounce the Ohio Supreme Court case correctly. So what say you on that point? Doesn't matter what Colorado's process is.
In terms of what ours is?
Yeah, I mean, let's assume for the moment that under the Ohio case, in Colorado, if he returned there, he could argue he's not a Tier 3, he's a Tier 1, and should be a Tier 1 because making him a Tier 3 is reopening his judgment of conviction. But it doesn't matter because he's in Nevada. And in Nevada, our process is different. So at least under a separation of powers analysis, it doesn't apply.
Well, I think, though, that...
What would discovery do for you in the district court on that argument?
Well, I think we also want to parse this down as just as to how it applies to MW. And whether AB 579 is constitutional under the Nevada Constitution, I believe is... You can draw from all of the people who will be affected by AB 579. And I'm sure that there are other people that are in the same situation as the Bodike, and I think that is how it's pronounced, the Bodike case. Even if it doesn't apply to MW, I think the law is still infirm. I would ask the court to maintain the preliminary injunction.
Okay, thank you very much, Mr. Langford. Ms. Buchanan, we appreciate your briefing and arguments in the case, and it will stand submitted. And the court will remain at ease and call.